Einheiten sind, die sich dieser Linie anschließen oder die das als Lebensqualität empfinden. Weil letztlich ist es ja eine Frage, wie wollen wir leben? Ist Lebensqualität das, dass wir uns an der Nase herumführen lassen von politischen Ideologien und Herrschaftsfraktionen, oder nehmen wir unser Schicksal in die eigenen Hände? Das ist eigentlich eine Idee, die bis heute ihre Strahlkraft hat, finde ich.
Thank you. against the wall, a night carousel. Tabaks and trees and small parachutes of guilt and showering me out of the scrublands beyond the building sites. It's a lie like any other lie, just showing us how far we've led to fall. We're back where we began, underneath this wall. Know what we choose to know, still fearing all. Tell me to accept, then you tell me to refuse the armor of the bride. Been offered to me by some lawyer standing somewhere behind me. His gloved hands try to cover my eyes, or make me think but never realize. But armor rusts in the rain, don't be answered by flies on the first.
цвета, цвета земли. Мой рот, как помойная яма, глаза, как цветы, злые, злые глаза мои, как цветы. Их ободок так красен, словно тюльпан. Они такие большие и мутные, как этот стакан. Злые, злые глаза мои, как цветы. По центру видишь пчела. Сосет и сосет из них кровь, вянут глаза.
Вянут, вянут глаза
мои, как цветы. Вянут, как цветы.
Yeah. Luisteraar van Radio Pattenpoel, lieve luisteraar van Ridder Radio, lieve luisteraar van DFM, lieve luisteraar van Ruigoord Radio, dan heb ik jullie allemaal gehad. Ik heb geleerd dat ik jullie allemaal een beetje aandacht moet geven. Netjes. Die kant op.
Ja, maar dat staat er gewoon niet op, hè?
Wat?
Ja, de oersonaten. En oersonaten.
De poppenkast, jawel. Poppenkast wel, maar niet de oersonaten. Of wel? Jawel, nee. Ja, weet ik niet.
Nou, ik heb je zo lang niet gesproken en dan gebeurt dit zo.
Ja, en dan zo, ja, sorry. Ik kan er niks aan doen. Ik zet hem zo ergens neer en dan kunnen we praten.
Ja, hier zijn we.
Het is een beetje verborgen. Ja. Hey Michel, mijn batterij is leeg, dus ik ga even bijlaaien. Maar
heel goed.
We zijn nog steeds aan het uitzenden.
Ja.
Dus ik hoorde dat jij de stream gekaapt had of zo.
Nee, dat denkt Sylvia.
Nog niet.
Ik heb al een paar keer uitgezonden.
Doe het dan.
Ik heb al een paar keer uitgezonden.
En dan komt de oersonate. Nou. Ga weg, doei.
Doei.
Ja.
Ja.
This is a download from the BBC.
Welcome to the forum on the BBC World Service, where we're discussing one of the most universally respected poets of all time, held in the same esteem by many as the great prophets. A 13th century Persian Islamic scholar whose encounter with a wandering dervish transformed him into a globally celebrated mystic and poet of love. His name, Jalal ad-Din Muhammad Rumi.
A lifetime without love is of no account. Love is the water of life. Drink it down with heart and soul.
Few figures in history have crossed borders of time, faith, language and geography as successfully as Rumi. He's been compared to Shakespeare and St. Francis of Assisi. His poems are as likely to be heard in churches, synagogues and monasteries as they are in yoga classes and pop songs. Why US artist Beyoncé has even named her son after him. He significantly inspired the whirling dervishes tradition and today he is one of the best-selling poets in America. We'll be discussing his life and poetry and understanding what gives him his global and enduring appeal. I'm Rajan Datar and I'm joined today by three experts on our subject. Poet and Rumi scholar, Fatima Keshavarz, biographer and also poet, Brad Gooch, who's made a pilgrimage out of Rumi's life, and academic specialist in Sufi mysticism and contemporary Islamic thought, Omid Safi. Welcome to you all. Let's start with Rumi's early life. People know he was born in 1207, but where that was has been more debated. Brad, what do we know about the location of his birth?
Well, we know he was born in Central Asia, and probably now it's felt that he was born in Tajikistan, and this is close to the now border of Afghanistan. So that area is where he was born. At that time, part of the greater Persian Empire, where there was a lot of poetic activity, spiritual activity, different religions, and these great cities like Balkh and Samarkand.
Tell me about his family. I think his father was a very strong character.
Yeah, well, he came from a family of Muslim teachers, preachers, religious leaders. And when he was 6 years old, he said that he was seeing angels. His father encouraged him in this, gave him kind of honorific titles like Coat of Angar and Jalaluddin, Glory of the Faith. And he pretty much followed in his father's footsteps.
But his father was quite a preeminent scholar and religious teacher.
Yes, he was. His grandfather was a preacher in Balkh, and his father had students who he would teach. And as his life went on and the family finally left Central Asia, his father grew in stature, really.
Well, you mentioned the upheaval from leaving Central Asia, and those were unsettled times when the Mongolian warrior Genghis Khan and his army were in full force. Brad Ruby and his family were essentially refugees then, weren't they? They undertook a remarkable journey.
Right. I mean, Genghis Khan and the Mongols descend on Central Asia. They're really the terrorists of their time in that sense. And Rumi and his family are traveling, perhaps going to Hajj on Mecca. And by the time they're in the Middle East, these great cities of Rumi's childhood have been destroyed. Some modern scholars say it was a genocide of the Persian population.
I think it was a 10-year odyssey across some 2,500 miles. And it kind of going along what is now the Silk Road, in a sense. Fatima, tell me, how much did this nomadic childhood and all these rich influences, how much did they affect his poetry?
I think very much. I think for one thing, he got a perspective on how cosmopolitan the Muslim world is, that his corner, his belief system, what he learned from his father is only a part of what he knows. He later on wrote that if trees were not earthbound, they would not be subjected to cutting. In other words, if you could move, you could change, and you could learn, and you could be a different person.
And when Rumi was in his early 20s, his family would eventually reach Konya, which is now in Turkey. Omid, where exactly is it, and what kind of place was it then?
Konya is a town which at that time was the capital of the Seljuk Empire. It is the new name given to the ancient Greek city of Iconium. So you have to imagine a place where the high culture is Persian, the rulers are Turks, probably a majority of the town people are Greeks, there are Jews and Armenians and Christian monks around. It's in what we would call an Islamicate society. It's a society with Muslims on top, but a cosmopolitan culture all the way through. And that's reflected in so many of the stories and anecdotes that we hear from Rumi, many of which have come from Greek sources, Christian sources, and some of them also from Hindu and Buddhist sources. That's the kind of eclectic, cosmopolitan Muslim civilization that Rumi found himself in and shapes at the same time.
I've got to say, Brad, it does seem like there is an awful lot of biographical detail about a man who lived 800 years ago. I mean, and you've written one of these biographies. What are the sources that people like you use?
Well, there are actually contemporary or near contemporary biographies of him. His son wrote a kind of biography in verse, and his grandson commissioned someone to go around and interview everyone who was still alive, who had known his grandfather Rumi, his father's notebooks, transcriptions of Rumi's talks to his students and Rumi's discourses, even letters. We have letters of Rumi's.
Okay, well, we were talking about Konya, and that would be the place that Rumi would be based until the end of his life. When he was around 25, his father died, and Rumi stepped into his shoes as a religious teacher. But it is some years later, in 1244, when Rumi is in his late 30s, that he meets a wandering mystic known as Shams of Tabriz, who would go on to change his life and work forever. Brad, what do we know about Shams of Tabriz?
Well, Shams of Tabriz, who was then around 60, was a sort of outlier mystic who had spent his life traveling through the Middle East, studying with the leading, especially Sufi mystical teachers of the time, comes to Konya, and Rumi and Shams meet and have a sort of electric connection. Immediately, Rumi's son, Sultan Velad, said that the veil fell from his father's eyes and he fell in love with Shams. And at this point, Rumi has four teaching posts at colleges. He has a wife, children, the disciples of his father. He's a sort of charismatic preacher and figure in Konya. So when he and Shams of Tabriz go off for 3 months in seclusion and then return and then for another 6 months go into seclusion, this obviously causes a lot of chaos around. And Shams is trying to encourage Rumi to move from a path of knowledge to a path of love in the heart, and from writing sermons and fatwas to composing poetry and using music and song in his meditation and spiritual practice.
If I could just stick, in a sense, with the relationship between the two of them, I mean, I think a lot of people would be perhaps a bit confused by it. I mean, Rumi was married with children. Was it a platonic relationship? Was it spiritual love, which is perhaps specific to the Persian culture of the time? Can you explain Umid in any way?
Absolutely. I think it is a deep, intense, and passionate friendship. There is no question that in this culture, beauty and the light of God and passion is something that can erupt through both the male form and the female form. He has this deep, passionate and mystical relationship and connection in a way that was quite common in a society in which your closest friendships were likely to be with people of your own gender.
Well, we know that their acquaintance lasts for around 3 years, and there is a mystery, in a sense, about how it ends. Brad, how does that happen?
In spite of the beauty going on between Rumi and Shams of Tabriz, this created a lot of controversy around them. Also, if you were from Central Casting and wanted to come up with a spiritual teacher, I don't know that you would come up with Shams of Tabriz, necessarily. I mean, there's something very misanthropic about him, and he was infatuated with Rumi and not very interested in anyone else. He was in a irascible character.
He winds people and up in a way.
Yeah, exactly. And also the relationship between them, I think it was more that it was disrupting even a traditional teacher-student sort of relationship, so that even Shams of Tabriz at one point says, are we teacher and student? Are we lover and beloved? Are we friend and companion? I need to know. Shams finally disappears without telling Rumi where he was going. We still don't finally know what happened to Shams of Tabriz. There were rumors that he had been murdered, perhaps by a jealous son of Rumi. There's no real evidence for that. But what we do know is that Rumi has a kind of breakdown because of this event. And out of this begins writing most of the poetry that we know him by today.
Well, you're right. The losing of Shams for Rumi is seen as a turning point in his life, transforming him from a scholar and professor of religion to the mystic and poet of love that we know today. And over the next 30 years, he would go on to compose an immense collection of verse. And here is one poem, That Simple Dance.
Ben mai rokh ke bagh o golestanam arzuz. Let me see your face. I adore gardens full of roses. Speak to me. I crave sweet words. Push the clouds out of your way. End the lingering night. Let me revel in the light I have long waited for. Beshnidam az havaye to avaz table baz, a royal falcon. Hearing the sound of the drums, I have returned, for I have no wish but to be yours. I have touched the depths of Jacob's sorrow. It is Joseph's arrival I am waiting for.
That's Fatima reading some verses from her translation of the poem That Simple Dance. And tell me, Fatima, that's an example of a ghazal, isn't it, of which Rumi wrote thousands. What is a ghazal?
Ghazal is a love poem, which is approximately between like 5 or 6 to 10 or 12 lines, though Rumi, who loves to break the rules, sometimes writes a ghazal that's 50 lines and one that's only 3 lines. Rumi did actually also write poetry before he met Shams and had a pen name called Khamush, which actually means silent. The poets used to put their own name in the very last verse of the ghazal in a way to introduce themselves, to talk to themselves or refer to themselves in the third person. After his connection with Shams, he changed that pen name to Shams.
Almost like a muse, is that what you're saying?
In a way much larger than that. It's a reflection of everything that he had learned in a philosophical, scholastic way. And he suddenly saw that all of that has to be embodied. It has to have a physical body about it, these ideas.
Omi, tell me, it's also said that when he writes, Rumi, when he writes about his love of Shams, he's also speaking of his love for God. Now, he was a Sufi, wasn't he? Tell us what Sufism is.
Well, Sufism is the path of love. It's the path that leads to God by going through humanity. It is the tradition of mysticism and spirituality that very much emulates the example of Muhammad. Muhammad rises to see God face to face, and the mystics who aspire to be like Muhammad also want to see the face of God. And the face of God that they see is partially in the human beings around them. So how would we live if we treated each person as a manifestation of God? Rumi at one point says, the intellect can take you to heaven, but if you want to enter into God's own being, you need to enter through love, because God is ultimately love.
And Fatima, we also know that while he was composing his poetry, he practiced whirling, and that he went on to inspire what are now known as the whirling dervishes. Can you explain what dervishes are?
Well, one day as he was walking through the goldsmith's market, the people who work with metals, they have these little hammers and chisels. As they work together, they create a wonderful music that echoes in the bazaar. As he was passing through the bazaar, he got ecstatic listening to this music, and he started whirling, and he whirled for 2 hours. Then it became a practice that he practiced many times in his own lifetime. One of his lessons is that you have to be centered, but also move. And that's what the whirling dervishes do. The other thing is that there's a gesture that they make, that one of their hands is towards the earth and the other one is towards the sky. The heaven and the earth need to be connected. Also, when you close your eyes and you whirl, you close a lot of your senses to the outside world, so you can actually focus inside for those moments of whirling.
Apart from the whirling, Rumi also produced teaching, texts and sermons. And aside from his vast collection of love poems, the Divan of Shams of Tabriz, his other most famous poetry comes from his work, the Masnavi-e-Manavi, written later in his life over a 12-year period. It's made up of a series of 6 books that together amount to 50,000 lines. The Masnavi is known as one of the most influential works of Sufism and is sometimes referred to as the Quran in Persian tongue. And here are the opening lines of the poem.
بشنوی نی چون شکایت می کند از جدائی ها حکایت می کند. Listen to the story told by the reed of being separated. کز نیستان تا مرا ببریده اند. Since I was cut from the reed bed, I've made this crying sound. Anyone apart from someone he loves understands what I say. Anyone pulled from a source longs to go back. At any gathering I'm there, mingling in the laughing and grieving, a friend to each, but few will hear the secrets hidden within the notes. No ears for that.
Some of the opening lines of the Song of the Reed there, as translated by Coleman Barks. Omid, more words of longing there. Anyone might read this as still being about Shams, but what for you is the message of the Masnavi?
You know, I think the Masnavi clearly is not a book that one read. It is a map of one's own inner journey to God. And when you take the Masnavi, and just taking that first book of the Masnavi, it starts by telling our story It's the story of exile. It's the story of brokenness. It's the story of suffering. It's the story of we look at ourselves and we feel that we're cut off from God, cut off from each other, cut off from our own hopes and dreams and aspirations. And then you go on this journey of love. You encounter these fantastic characters that Rumi tells you, oh, by the way, these are all you. These are not outside of you. They're all your own qualities. And eventually we end up with a story that is all about healing and becoming whole and becoming truly what it means to be human. It's a journey of love from separation and brokenness to wholeness and healing.
And these, Fatima, are parables in a sense, aren't they? I mean, are they? Does that make them easier to read and understand in a sense?
Oh, absolutely. There are so many deep and abstract ideas that are expressed that if he didn't put them into stories, that it would be really hard to understand. There's a story, for example, of this man who followed Jesus and asked him to teach him how to bring the dead to life. And of course, Jesus understood that that's not a trick. He had told this man, you're not able to use this. You're not ready for this. But finally, because of his insistence, according to the story, Jesus gave him this power. So the man's very happy and walking down the forest and he sees a dead lion. And he says, oh, this is the moment to try this. And he brings the lion to life. And of course, what does the lion do? He eats him up. It's a way to say that you have to learn by living the principles that you absorb one by one and then break lovingly, and then move on to a new one. And this is an ongoing process. It's not something that I can just snap a finger and give you. So the Masnavi is very long and full of these stories. And actually, in my household, we have many, many times started and finished the Masnavi with friends over a period of 7 years. And so you go through this, you talk about them, you absorb them, and then hopefully you have made a step for yourself.
It's important to say that these are not just kind of abstract stories. These are kind of like life lessons. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. A lot of them are so mundane. It's very often very funny, very down to earth. And sometimes he uses a language which is sometimes, in fact, difficult to read out loud because it has sexual allusions.
Well, Omid, I think you have a good example of that, don't you?
Well, depends on the rating of your program as to how graphic you want us to get. When the Victorian English were translating Rumi's poetry, they were so scandalized by the graphic nature that they could not sully the good English language. So Nicholson, the great British scholar, puts them in Latin. Because presumably only Oxbridge gentlemen who have had Greek and Latin training are sophisticated enough to handle the mystical and clearly not sexual nature of these stories.
Nonetheless, it is regarded as a controversial work, Fatima, isn't it? Why do you think this is?
Yes, these have been over time controversial. There have been people within the Islamic tradition, even within the Persian language, readers of Rumi's work, who've been very skeptical and who have not considered these to be real, true ways of teaching. But first of all, I would say that he intended that controversy. He never wanted to be the teacher who sits there and gives you facts and figures and you just go ahead and follow that. He wanted you to be surprised and angry and playful and all of these things.
Well, the Masnavi was written in the latter part of Rumi's life, and Bratty died in 1273 in Konya, which is now in Turkey, as we said, where he spent much of his life. The day of his death has come to be referred to as his wedding night. Now, tell me why that is, and what do we know about his funeral?
In a certain way, Rumi used his death as a teaching opportunity. He, on his deathbed, was writing poetry about death, supposedly. Some of these lines that are included on his tomb, like, if you come to visit my tomb, be sure to bring a tambourine, showed his attitude. And the other was this idea that it was his wedding night and his moment of reunion with the divine, and in some sense, Shams. And this was also then reflected in his funeral, which he planned. in which he had traditional Quranic reciters in front of the casket, and then behind there were dancers and singers singing his poetry. You had Christian priests reciting the Gospels and Jewish rabbis reciting the Psalms.
Okay, so far we've talked about Rumi's early life as a traveller across the Middle East and heard about the life-changing encounter that transformed him into a whirling poet of love and ecstasy. His poems have travelled across time, languages, faiths and geographies. He's a best-selling poet in the USA and has inspired spiritual teachers, world-famous musicians and Hollywood stars. Listen to this.
A lover asked his beloved, "Do you love yourself more than you love me?" The beloved replied, "I have died to myself and I live for you. I've disappeared from myself and my attributes. I am present only for you. I've forgotten all my learning. From knowing you, I have become a scholar. I have lost all my strength, but from your power, I am able."
Actress Demi Moore there reading Do You Love Me from Deepak Chopra's album, A Gift of Love, which is inspired by translations of Rumi. Omid, an example there of how Rumi has been adopted by the New Age movement. I know you're not a complete fan of that. Before we tackle translation and popularity in the West, there are still several hundred years to account for. Omid, what do we know about how Rumi's works travelled across the world immediately after his death?
I think to get a sense of the impact that Rumi has had on this wide landscape, including Mughal India, Iran, Central Asia, the Ottoman realms, places like Bosnia, you have to remember that before the invention of the modern printing press, every copy of a book that we had was a book that someone copied by hand. And so if you want to get a sense of the influence of a certain author or poet or text, we can count how many copies of it we have in different manuscript libraries. And it turns out that when we look at this eastern part of the Muslim majority world, the texts after the Quran that were copied the most are texts of Rumi, texts of Hafez, these texts of erotic, passionate, mystical poetry.
And after his death, were there specific spiritual teachers who continued his legacy?
Absolutely. So the Mevlevi order, Rumi's own order, was one vehicle, but that order more or less develops in the Ottoman world, which is in many ways the modern Arab and Turkish Middle East and significant parts of Southeast Europe. In the Safavid realm, which is the Iranian realm, the Central Asian realm, and also the Mughal realm of India, which are also, of course, Persian-speaking at this time in their court tradition, Rumi's poetic tradition becomes followed by a whole host of sages and spiritual teachers who use his poetry in the Masnavi to elucidate the life challenges and questions and dilemmas that people are coming to them with. So there has been this living tradition of 700 years of commentary, both in forms of actual commentary text written on the Masnavi and also individuals whose entire life and being becomes, as it were, a kind of walking commentary, breathing commentary on the Masnavi.
And Brad, what do we know about how his work came to be translated into English first and how it came?